I'm Tanzina Vega. It's The Takeaway, and we're glad to have you here. For many Americans, turning on the tap and being able to brush your teeth, take a shower, or even boil an egg with the water that comes out of it is pretty normal. But new research estimates that more than 1 million Americans don't have access to clean running water and plumbing.
When we think of water and sanitation problems, we think of, you know, sub-Saharan Africa or Asia or parts of Latin America. But right here in the United States, at least 1.6 million people don't have a working tap or a toilet at home.
That's George McGraw, and he's the founder and CEO of Dig Deep, a nonprofit in Los Angeles who calls the problem water poverty.
If you don't have access to regular hot and cold clean running water in your home, something like a tap or a toilet, you experience a kind of poverty that is, you know, worse than material or financial poverty. Your lack of access to water means you probably don't have access to a good job, to a steady education, to a steady life of health and happiness.
The problem is particularly severe in Native communities where, according to the National Congress of American Indians, 13% of Native households lack access to clean water. That's compared to just 1% of American households overall.
No running water whatsoever, nothing. I wish, you know, I could see water coming out of the faucet. Mm-hmm. I wish I could see the water flushing down. I don't know, someday I might.
Jan Hudson is a 66-year-old resident of Baca, New Mexico, an area with a high population of Native residents. This is a clip from her interview with Dig Deep.
And I have to go far to get water, you know. Like this morning, I went all the way down to Grants to get water and come right back.
And how long of a trip is that to Grants?
Grants is 20 miles, 40 miles round trip. 45 minutes to get my water, get a few more things, and then I come home. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I try to get really conservative and try to just use two jugs for the day. Mm-hmm. When it's time to wash my hair, you know, I have to use two jugs of water
right.
to wash my hair.
More than 2,000 miles away, a natural disaster revealed a water crisis on the island of Puerto Rico.
Maria was like an F2, F3 tornado on top of your head for 12 hours. So you can imagine the destruction. There was no water, no power for months. In my area, we were without water 5 months.
That's Arturo Medina, a doctor in the community of Monteverde. And while there was a lot of attention after Hurricane Maria centered on the island's prolonged lack of power, the need for clean water was also a serious concern.
In our case, it was 175 families. We had the pump, we had the well, we had a tank, but we did not have power. FEMA and the U.S. Corps of Engineers and the government said they were going to help us. Nobody came over. The other system we have for water was rainwater. We collected rainwater. So using this, we limped for 5 months. So that's the way we reuse water, for example. If you wash, you got a washing machine going with a small generator, the water that came out of the washing machine, you use it for your toilets.
Arturo says the reality of their situation didn't square with living in the richest country in the world.
United States of America. I can't believe it. For me, it doesn't fit in my head. No, cabe en la cabeza, which means that it doesn't go into my brain in a straight way. Rich country, people don't have water, but the most basic need, I can't, doesn't, something's not right. Water is life. Agua vida. Without water, in 5 days, you're dead. So that's just the absence of water. You could stay weeks without food, but you couldn't stay days without water.
If you don't have access to regular hot and cold clean running water in your home, something like a tap or a toilet, you experience a kind of poverty that is, you know, worse than material or financial poverty.
Water poverty isn't prioritized as an issue in the United States, and there's very little data on the problem. So I asked George McGraw how he came to that 1.6 million person figure.
Well, the estimate's really simple. It's actually built off of census data from the American Community Survey, where we ask people, you know, what their house is like. But we also know that these are really vulnerable communities, right? They're socioeconomically marginalized communities of color, a lot of tribal communities, African-American communities, rural communities. And so they're difficult to sample, which is why I say at least 1.6 million in the U.S. still don't have this. And to your bigger question around why, I mean, that's really what my organization, Dig Deep, and some of our partners are trying to figure out. Why in the richest country in the world would we have this core of millions of people who still don't have access to something the rest of us take completely for granted? And, you know, the short answer is it's complicated. It's race, it's poverty, it's economic development, it's marginalization. But no matter what's causing it, it doesn't need to be happening. This is a problem we can absolutely solve in our lifetimes.
And I want to be clear for our listeners that we are here on The Takeaway and beyond. We're aware of water infrastructure collapses, particularly in places like Flint, Michigan. We've talked about Newark, New Jersey here on the show. We've also looked at Baltimore. But what you're talking about goes beyond contaminated water. And it's just a question of access to water, period, right?
Yeah, this is completely different. I mean, we do have a water contamination and a water infrastructure problem in this country, $1 trillion underinvestment. And cities like Flint, what's happening in Baltimore, water pricing, these are sort of the canaries in the coal mine. But in this big national conversation that's happening about the state of our water infrastructure, we seem to be forgetting that there are people who have no access to that infrastructure at all. People who woke up this morning on a place like the Navajo Nation, for instance, which is our country's largest native reservation, and who walked out of their house with a bucket a couple miles to maybe a livestock pond or a trough and drew out a couple gallons of dirty water, and that's all they'll have to use today. And they'll use that water for cooking, cleaning, drinking, bathing right here in the United States. And their kids go to public school. In a lot of cases, these people, you know, pay taxes, you know, have full citizenship status. You know, this is a problem affecting our neighbors, people like you and I.
George, would you call this a health crisis?
Oh, absolutely. Tanzina, imagine that you couldn't use a sink or a shower this morning. And imagine that you're a younger woman and have to go to school with a bunch of kids that did. Not only are you, is your health in every way affected, your ability to ward off disease, your ability to keep your gut health healthy, your ability to take care of basic needs like menstruation. And then you head to a school and you bring some of these difficulties into a public place where they're easy to pass off to other children, to other peers. These communities often deal with things like waterborne illnesses that are rarely seen in the U.S. In some counties in West Virginia that we've been looking at, rates of waterborne disease are higher than they are in developing countries like Haiti.
So tell us a little bit about Dig Deep and what it is that you're trying to do now.
So we're working on places like I mentioned, the Navajo Nation, on community-based infrastructure in places that water lines or sanitation lines won't work. We help organize communities into solutions like trucking programs that maybe pick up water at a well and deliver it to your house and pump it into a tank underground where we can use solar energy to bring it into your sink or your shower or your toilet. And at the same time, you know, we're trying to wrap our head around what this problem really looks like across the United States, because the census data is just fragmentary and inconclusive. It doesn't tell us where these communities are, what kinds of problems they're facing related to water and sanitation. So we're engaged in a few big research efforts with major foundations and institutions like Michigan State University and the U.S. Water Alliance to really reanalyze that national data to show us what this problem actually looks like. And then we're embedding researchers in six communities across the country that are experiencing these water and sanitation issues to figure out what's really going on the ground.
Tell us about your six communities. Where are they and why did you pick them?
Well, you know, this problem is experienced across the country in every one of the 50 states. But we picked six hotspots. These are the places that are sort of emblematic or representative of other parts of the country where people are experiencing the same thing. So the six hotspots are the California Central Valley, the Four Corners region of the Southwest, primarily tribal areas, the U.S.-Mexico border colonias or irregular communities, primarily in Texas, some rural counties of the Deep South in states like Mississippi and Alabama that are predominantly Black, and then some rural counties of Appalachia, Kentucky, West Virginia, and finally San Juan and some of the surrounding areas in Puerto Rico. And in each of these places, there are Americans who don't have access to running water or a working toilet. And we're trying to figure out why, how they're experiencing that, and how we can end that problem.
Have you guys found anything yet? Is there any research that you can share with us so far, even if it's preliminary?
Oh, absolutely. We found some really interesting things. There are really strong correlations between race and a lack of access to basic plumbing. And that probably doesn't come as a surprise to most people in 2019 in the United States. But the numbers show that if you're African American, but especially if you're Native American, you are less likely, markedly less likely, to have a working tap or a toilet in your home. The data is also showing us how these communities can kind of hide. So, for instance, in Coconino County in Arizona, 3% of homes don't have a working tap or toilet. That's at the county level. And that's usually where we look at this kind of data. But we've been recoding that data so we can look deeper at a census tract level, which is like a zip code. And if you zoom in, you find zip codes in there that are predominantly Native American, where 41% of homes don't have a working tap or a toilet. And this, you know, sort of goes to show that these communities, usually of color, usually marginalized in other ways, like socioeconomically, are hiding inside groups of people that are larger and more homogenous, and those numbers are harder to find.
George, do we have a right to water in this country? I mean, it just feels like this is so basic in terms of our survival. To know that there are Americans who don't have access to running water, who don't have working toilets, who are using outhouses, it just boggles the mind. What do we have a right to water?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm a human rights practitioner myself. I have a firm belief that every human being has a right to the things they need to live a full life in dignity. And absolutely, water and sanitation is one of those basic things. When it comes to rights in the United States, of course, we mostly talk about civil and legal rights. In some states, for instance, here in California, where I'm based, we have a constitutionally enshrined human right to water. It doesn't have very strong legal teeth, but certainly the concept is there. And there are people like us over at Dig Deep and in other organizations working to strengthen those rights and give people more access to them. But it's interesting because as a global community, we, you know, passed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights coming out of World War II and enshrined all of these rights to life and livelihood, and we didn't include water. I think primarily because so many of us just took it for granted. So there's been a big push in the international community since 2010 to understand the human right to water better, to protect people's access to it. In fact, in the 25-year period ending in 2015, every country in the world sort of has been working on water and sanitation access, and we've provided access to improved drinking water for 2.6 billion people and to improve sanitation for 2.1 billion people. And while almost every country, even the poorest of the poor, are making progress around the world, it seems like somehow here in the U.S. we're slipping backwards.
How is that possible? Don't we have some of the smartest people in the world working on these issues internationally?
Sure. I mean, I spend a lot of my time trying to convince friends and colleagues that are working on eradicating this problem in countries like Swaziland or South Sudan to come back and work at home. But, you know, so many of the institutions set up to solve systemic poverty issues, or at least address them abroad, aren't really navel-gazing. They're not internally focused. And that goes from, you know, the institutions that are funding them to the people working in them. The focus for so long has been, you know, we have so much, how can we help others? And now we're really discovering, I think recently more than ever, the limitations of our own development here at home and how far behind we've fallen in things like infrastructural investment, education, even the state of our current political dialogue.
How come we haven't had a more severe or more intense public policy response to this so far? Or has there been? And we're just not aware of it.
No, there hasn't been. And, you know, I'm sort of the poster child for that, because at the beginning of my career, when I started to get into water and sanitation, I immediately packed up and went over to Africa and started working too. I had no idea this was a problem in my own country. And I think that's for two reasons. One, water infrastructure in general is sort of out of sight, out of mind, right? It's not like an airport or a bridge. It's not something you see every day. We've been trained by cheap, abundant water as Americans to take it completely for granted. Most people wouldn't know where to get water if their tap stopped working tomorrow. I think that's one problem. The other problem is that the communities this affects are truly marginalized. These are the most vulnerable populations in our country, and they're not attracting the national attention that they need to. So, you know, tragedies like Flint, while terrifying, and while their effects on human lives are, you know, lamentable and we need to avoid them at all costs, have served a really important purpose, which is to wake people up to the fact that you just can't rely on these things in the United States anymore. And we need, you know, as citizens, as Americans, to pay more attention to these issues and to take matters into our own hands and do something about it.
George McGraw is the founder and executive director of Dig Deep in Los Angeles. George, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
Hey, we need your help. You are a big part of this show, how we think about things and how we choose what to cover. Got an idea or a guest we should talk to? Get with us on our Facebook page or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is your takeaway. Last week, an intense winter storm swept the Midwest. The floods that followed caused at least 3 deaths, thousands of forced evacuations, and could cost more than $1 billion. Nebraska was hit especially hard, suffering major ranching and farming losses.
Our governor has called it the biggest disaster, weather-related disaster in Nebraska history, and having lived in this state for 42 years, I would have to agree with him.
Ken Anderson is a reporter and anchor in Lincoln, Nebraska for Brownfield, an agriculture news outlet.
You know, no one really predicted how this would go. It's a pretty unique event. There were some warnings about possible flooding, and farmers that lived right along those rivers were moving their livestock to higher ground and doing what they could to prepare for it. But no one in their wildest imagination ever dreamt that it would happen this way, where the rivers would flood out miles, several miles beyond the rivers. Just wasn't much preparation that could be done for that.
Even before this particular weather event, farms in the Midwest are struggling, and they have been for a while. We understand that there was a 20% jump in the number of Midwest farms that were filing for bankruptcy. Can you help us put this into context as far as why farms are going bankrupt?
The floods won't help, that's for sure. For those farmers that have been hit who are already struggling financially, it's going to be another big blow. And in some cases, you know, some of them, it may put them out of business. You know, farmers had some really good years back from 2010 to 2013. Commodity prices were high. The ethanol production, ethanol plants were being built and producing ethanol. It drove corn prices up to some record highs, and they did really well during that period. In the past 5 years, commodity prices have fallen and have stagnated, and it has been a tough time for farmers. Yes, bankruptcies are up, although I would point out they are, when you talk about percentages, they're coming from some pretty low numbers to start with. A lot of those bankruptcy numbers, we believe, are related to the dairy industry in areas such as Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and of course, California being the top dairy producing state. But the dairy industry has had a lot of issues as far as declining demand for milk. I think a lot of those bankruptcy numbers are probably related to the dairy industry. Crop farmers, for the most part, have held on pretty well.
One of the first things we think about when we see extreme weather is climate change. How does the agricultural industry see this? Do they see this as something that's linked to climate change? And are they looking at ways to protect themselves going forward? Or is that not a top concern?
The big debate is whether this is a permanent change or whether it's just a weather cycle. I've seen some folks attributing this bomb cyclone and the events that have happened here to climate change. But I'm guessing if you went out and talked to farmers in the state, you'd probably find, you know, well over 3/4 of them still saying, this is weather, this is Nebraska, we face this on a regular basis. Now, this is more serious than a lot of the weather events that we get. But, you know, farmers out here are used to drought on a semi-regular basis. They're used to years where there's too much rain. They're always fighting the elements out here. And I think that causes a lot of them to look at the climate change arguments with a little bit of skepticism. As far as how they're adapting, though, to these more extreme weather events, they have taken steps to adapt. And one of the ways they're doing that over the years is they're moving to larger equipment. So as they have smaller windows of opportunity in the spring to plant their crops and in the fall to harvest their crops, they've gone to larger equipment that allows them to complete those tasks on a much faster pace. So, for example, in the past, in planting a crop where it may have taken them, you know, 6 weeks, if they have good weather, they're able to complete it in about half that time now.
Ken, I'm wondering, overall, what do you think reconstruction is going to look like long term for the region, for Nebraskans, and for farmers?
For the individual farmers, it's going to take a lot of time once the waters have receded to go out and, first of all, to clean up the debris that's going to be in their fields. I mean, there's going to be trees, branches, all kinds of things that are going to be left in their fields when those waters recede. For the livestock farmers that suffered losses of cattle and hogs, you know, they're going to have to clean up the aftermath of that, remove the dead livestock, and see what they can do to rebuild. One of the big issues that's going to affect more than just those individuals is the number of highways and bridges that have been damaged through this flooding. The State Department of Transportation here is saying that there's 200 miles of state highways that have to be repaired or replaced. There's 11 bridges, some pretty significant bridges that have been closed because of the flooding, some completely destroyed. And in Nebraska and all of the Midwest, transportation is such an important thing, transportation of agricultural products to and from markets. I'll give you an example of the dairy industry here in the state. Milk has to be picked up on a daily basis from those dairy farms. And the State Department of Agriculture says, with the roads closing, the bridges being closed, that a lot of those milk pickup trucks are having to travel 100 to 150 miles more just to get to where they can pick up the milk because of the damage that's been done to roads and bridges. Cattle and hog industries facing some of the same challenges. Also, we had a lot of railroad lines that were washed out or damaged by the flooding. And the railroad system is very important for transport of grain products in the state. Ethanol that is being produced in the state all goes by rail. So it's going to take some time to rebuild. We're waiting to see about a federal disaster declaration, which would bring some federal funds in, which would have to be matched by state funds to start making some of these repairs.
Ken Anderson from the agriculture news outlet Brownfield, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Last November, Floridians voted to restore voting rights to felons who had served their sentences. Now, just months later, new bills are working their way through the Florida legislature that could disenfranchise almost half of them all over again. Kira Lerner is a reporter at The Appeal covering criminal justice and voting. Kira, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So we've been covering this story here on The Takeaway pretty regularly. Give us the rundown here of where we are and how we got here.
Sure. I think most people remember back November when Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment to restore voting rights to roughly 1.4 million people. It was a monumental day in Florida, the biggest single restoration of voting rights since women's suffrage. So there was a lot of celebration in Florida, and rightly so. The advocates that pushed for the passage of this amendment claimed that their amendment was self-actualizing, which means it does not require any act of the legislature or the governor to take effect. But when Governor Ron DeSantis took office, he disputed that. And the GOP-controlled legislature has, in the last few months, started debating and discussing whether they are going to pass some kind of clarifying legislation. In the House earlier this week, we saw a bill pass its first hurdle and moved out of committee, and that bill would require the payments of all fines, fees, and court costs before people with felony convictions are eligible to vote. And a lot of opponents call that a modern-day poll tax. They say that it is punishing the poor and essentially making it so that anyone that is too poor to pay off those fees is not eligible to vote.
Kira, let me ask you a question here, because this seems to be, we talked about, you mentioned clarifying the legislation. I think the legislation was pretty clear, right, when the voters in the Floridians voted on passing this. Is this a question of disenfranchising this group all over again?
That is what a lot of the voting advocates would say. The language of the amendment says that rights are restored upon completion of an individual sentence. The lawmakers that are pushing for these so-called clarifying bills say that that language is unclear. They are not sure what completion of a sentence means.
I want to just interject and say that does completion of a sentence not mean you've done your time and you've left and you're done?
That's how most people would define it, yes. They're trying to take a broader definition and say that completion of sentence also includes the payments of all fines and fees, which is problematic in a place like Florida that we know uses a system that a lot of people call cash register justice, and they levy small fines and fees on people who are too poor to pay after they leave the justice system. And these people are burdened with debt for oftentimes their entire lives because they struggle to find jobs, and most people do not pay off these fees that have been levied by the court systems. So essentially, while this amendment was intended to undo lifetime voting bans, requiring the payment of fines and fees would do just that all over again.
Now, how constitutional is this? You mentioned that this, a lot of folks are saying this is similar to a poll tax. It would seem to me that, and particularly in the state of Florida, I've done reporting there that, you know, there are some places in Florida that charge inmates for having been incarcerated. How constitutional is what they're proposing right now?
Well, there are a lot of groups that have already threatened legal action if this bill were to become law. And I think we are likely to see litigation if that's the case. It's still unclear how a court in Florida would rule on this. We know that the Supreme Court has been open to requiring the payment of certain fees before voting. We saw the North Dakota voter ID law was approved by the Supreme Court, even though North Dakota was requiring Native American voters to get some kind of government ID in order to vote, which levied fees on them. We know that Governor Ron DeSantis has tilted the state Supreme Court towards conservative lawmakers. All three chambers of Florida's government are controlled by Republicans right now. So there are a lot of fears from voting advocates that there are a lot of fears by voting advocates in Florida that a bill like this could be upheld as constitutional.
Let's talk a little bit about who would mostly be affected. We are sort of skirting around the issue of race, I think, but in the population that stands to lose the most here are largely low-income people of color. Is that not right?
That's correct. And we know that previously, Florida's permanent felon disenfranchisement law disproportionately affected people of color. We know that people of color are more likely to have fines and fees levied on them, and we know that they're less likely to be able to pay them off over the course of their lives. There's another bill working its way through the Senate that would broaden the definition of murder to include things like attempted murder and felony manslaughter. And we know that those convictions are also disproportionately people of color.
What is the likelihood, Kira, that this bill will be passed? I mean, it sounds like short of any major change here, it's most likely going to be, given the political situation on the ground in Florida.
Exactly. With all three chambers of Florida's government controlled by Republicans, voting advocates really fear that this stands a good chance of passing. But there is a lot of backlash, and this is getting a lot of attention right now. The advocates with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, the biggest group that pushed for the passage of this amendment, are already raising the alarms. They're encouraging people to call their lawmakers. They were up in the Capitol earlier this week pushing their lawmakers not to pass any kind of bill that would undermine the intent of the voters. And I think we see a lot of people who call themselves returning citizens, people with felony convictions, pushing really hard against this legislation. I talked to one man, Fort Myers resident Lance Wissinger, who thought that he would qualify to vote under Amendment 4. He drove drunk when he was 24 years old and killed his friend who was in the passenger seat of his car. He was convicted of DUI manslaughter and did not think that he would be excluded from the restoration of voting rights. But the bill that's moving its way through the Senate would exclude people convicted of felony manslaughter like him. So I think there are a lot of people in his position that are going to push back and see if they can do anything about this.
Kira Lerner is with The Appeal, where she reports on criminal justice and voting. Kira, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Okay, let's call the cops.
I did. They're 14 minutes away.
What? 14 minutes? Okay. Jason, give me the bat.
That's a clip from Us, Jordan Peele's latest movie. His directorial debut, Get Out, premiered in 2017 to rave reviews, and the satirical horror film earned Peele an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. Well, this weekend, Us opens up in theaters across the U.S., and it's already generated plenty of buzz at festivals like South by Southwest. And that's what we hear from Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, Tanzina.
And we've also got Valerie Complex, a freelance writer covering cinema. So good to have you here in studio. Welcome to The Takeaway, Valerie.
What's up? How you doing?
What is this about, Valerie?
Oh, heck. If I'm going to be simple without giving away spoilers, it's a middle-class family who's, you know, confronted by their have-not doppelgangers. That's it. That's all I'm going to give you.
Rafer, how would you summarize it?
I would agree, although I think what's great about the film, very much like with Get Out as well, is that sort of basic premise, that rather simple premise that you start with, gets progressively weirder and weirder.
Mm-hmm. Get Out is still with me. Big expectations here, right, Rafer? Like, what happens now? Will it stack up?
Right. It's hard to follow up one of these out of nowhere debuts that gets everyone very excited about you. You know, you're the hot young thing.
No pressure, right?
No pressure, right. But I think you saw early on the reviews out of South by Southwest were just glowing. People calling him the next Hitchcock, the next Spielberg. And I have to say for myself, I was very, very impressed with this film. It is, it's fantastic. It's just as interesting as Get Out. I think it reaches a little deeper in some ways, but it's pretty marvelous. And again, very unique, very different. Nothing else out there is like this.
Valerie, we were talking a little bit before the segment about what genre this really falls into. It's not, you don't consider it typically horror, right?
It is horror, but it just goes into another subcategory. And this is just, you know, another facet of horror that would be more psychological. We've seen those type of films throughout history, like with Rosemary's Baby and other films like it. And, you know, Jordan Peele is really carving out a career that's sort of all his own. I know he gets a lot of comparisons, but he's really doing something unique and sort of, you know, something that gives him, you know, the autonomy to sort of be allowed to create the stories that he wants.
And what makes it terrifying, if you will, what made Get Out scary was, for me, and I'm curious to know what you think about comparing this to Us, was that it was all the rest of it. It wasn't so much the horror itself as it was the sort of psychological, racial, social underpinnings that were happening there. Rafer, Get Out was a huge hit for Jordan. Does Us try to do something different?
I think it does. Get Out, of course, was very specifically about race and racism fears on that subject in America. This is, and he's been very explicit about this in interviews because there's been so much curiosity about it. He's been very explicit that this is not a film that's about color necessarily. Although the family in the film is African-American, and there are some notes, you know, some references to this in the film. But really, this is a film about one family confronting their doppelgangers, their doubles, who come after them. And I think this film reaches a lot deeper into a kind of class consciousness and not so much a color consciousness to me. Watching this film, this family, this sort of thwarted, stunted, perverted mirror image of this family that comes after this nice, affluent, all-American family, made me think when I was watching it, like, this is almost the first Marxist horror film. Like, this is a real statement about, you know, the literal underground, because that's where they come from, the literal underdogs coming up and coming after us. And that's pretty interesting.
Valerie, I'm curious to know what you think about that, because when black characters, particularly in horror films, are A, almost non-existent, mm-hmm. B, almost first killed off. And mm-hmm. Now, what does Jordan Peele do here that's different? Because you interviewed him before that.
Right. I think what he does here is he puts a African-American or black family into a middle-class setting, which is not something that we normally hear about or see, probably because the middle class is shrinking in America. But African-American middle-class folks exist. And
does it to Rafer's point, does he, the tropes that come up, the racialized tropes that come up, for example, one of the strong black woman, like how does Jordan Peele really sort of challenge that in the film?
I think the way he challenges it is he sort of shows the stress of revolution and how, and I talked to him about this, and, you know, that was something that he mentioned was intentional, this sort of black woman superhero trope where you have a woman who is at the center of this revolution, which is something that you see in American society throughout. If you look at the, you know, Black Lives Matter movement, the creators are women. If you look at the Me Too movement, Tarana Burke is a black woman. And I think that says a lot about how stressful that can be on a woman, and for a woman to go to protect, you know, how far she goes to protect her family, because Lupita Nyong'o's character, Adelaide, is pretty much in charge.
Valerie, you've written about how much you admire Lupita Nyong'o's performance, but you also talk about the kids in the movie. Tell me about that.
One of the things that I appreciate about us specifically is sort of the ushering in of the creepy black child. We have many, many horror films and psychological films in general, like The Good Son or The Children of the Corn or Damien, where you see young children who are creepy, who are menacing, but you never see that with black children. You have Wes Craven's The People Under the Stairs. You have Candyman 2, Farewell to the Flesh, where you see young black children involved in horror, but they aren't the catalyst. They aren't the ones doing the violence. But in Us, you see that with the characters, like the young actress Madison Curry, who's at the beginning, who you'll see Shahidi Wright and Evan Alex. You know, their doppelgangers are menacing. They are creepy. They are scary. They are violent. And when you see black children in media, it's usually, you know, comedies or something where you see people in the ghetto, you know, and they're, you know, the victim of gang violence or something like that. But this is something that was also intentional. When I spoke to Jordan Peele, he was like, I wanted to do that because it was uncharted territory, as he put it. And he's right. And it hit me hard because, you know, I remember growing up as a kid and people thinking I was creepy because I had all of these, you know, different interests. They weren't anything crazy. I used to, like, watch anime and all these different things. I liked horror movies and stuff. But to see it on screen and to see young children that looked like me when I was growing up, I really enjoyed that aspect of the film. It freaked me out, sends chills up my spine just thinking about it, but in a good way.
And I also want to bring up the idea that, like as Rafer said, a lot of people are comparing him to the next Hitchcock. You think he's carving out his own genre, mm-hmm. Jordan Peele. What? How do you make that distinction there?
I think I find that with a lot of directors, particularly of color, there's this rush for people to sort of compare them to others. And I don't know if that's because that makes them feel comfortable or whatever, but he's really doing something that no other director has done. Spielberg hasn't really put, you know, I love his films, but you don't see his films with a lot of black leads.
Mm. Particularly in this genre.
Particularly, right, in this genre.
We've got about 30 seconds left. Does Jordan Peele manage to balance this social commentary while also trying to entertain folks? Valerie, 2 seconds.
Yes.
Rafer.
Yes, I think he does. I think he does in an even deeper way, possibly, than he did in Get Out.
And do you think this is going to resonate, Valerie, with fans?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's going to disturb a lot of folks. It's going to have them thinking about it for days, maybe even weeks. I'm still thinking about it months.
I'm sure for months. Valerie Complex is a freelance writer covering cinema, and Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. Going out with a little more from the Us soundtrack. Thanks for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Will somebody wear me?